The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. HBO's new series Westworld is based on a 1973 movie written and directed by the novelist Michael Crichton. Both versions are set in a futuristic Western-themed amusement park where very wealthy adults indulge their fantasies on the startlingly human-like, responsive robot hosts which populate the park. No surprise, things take a bad turn.
Do you know where you are?
I'm in a dream.
Have you ever questioned the nature of your reality?
No.
You and everyone you know were built to gratify the desires of the people who pay to visit your world. What if I told you that you can't hurt the newcomers?
Don't you touch her!
And that they can do anything they want to you.
That's just a little clip from Westworld. The show's slick design and visuals get high praise from audiences and critics and beg the question, in the age of 3D printing and advanced artificial intelligence, are the cutting-edge host robots from Westworld just around the bend? Lux Alpdrom is a writer, consultant, and sex educator who looked into that very question for Motherboard. And Lux, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to chat robots.
We're going to do our best to avoid spoilers. But how about just starting with a little bit of a description of the Westworld hosts? You know, how lifelike are they?
So the Westworld hosts are extremely lifelike. I mean, not surprisingly, they're played by human actors, so they look like human beings. But even beyond that superficial resemblance to real people, they're able to bleed, they're able to eat, they respond to injury in the same way that we would. Like, there have been episodes where you see a host get beat up and be bruised and then heal. They also are able to convincingly have a conversation like a human. What's interesting with Westworld is that they talk a lot about these hosts being part of pre-programmed storylines and they're following paths, but within that world, any guest can come in and completely derail a storyline. I might go in and decide I'm going to kill off a character, and the hosts then have to adapt.
So they respond, they bleed when cut, they appear to emote, they adapt. Any of these aspects close to our current ability to produce human-like androids?
Unfortunately, not so close. Or fortunately,
depending on
your perspective. It's funny, I went into this and I was like, well, we're probably fairly close on some of it. And my initial thought when I started researching this was, well, probably the body exterior stuff, that's probably a little bit further away. But the AI stuff, we're probably pretty close on that. And while we're not really close on any of it, it's actually the reverse. We are closer on the exterior and kind of the simulation of a human body than we are on the simulation of a human mind.
Yeah, so you spoke to somebody who is actually working on growing skin.
Yes, yeah, so I spoke to this fantastic artist, Amy Carl. She has this art project, Regenerative Reliquary, where she has a bioprinted scaffold that's in the shape of a hand, and she embedded stem cells in it. And the idea of that project is over the course of 2 years, those stem cells will eventually grow into all of the different types of cells that are in a human hand. So that's actually really, really cool. And she told me a lot about science that's being done and research that's being done on growing skin. And that's something that she personally is familiar with because in addition to the artwork that she's done, she also just personally has had a lot of skin grafts over her life.
Well.
And what she told me was that skin grafts and growing skin, actually not that hard. We're pretty good at artificially creating skin from collagen, at just growing skin, potentially growing artificial skin that is a blend of synthetic fibers and organic fibers. But the problem is that, you know, you can grow a huge sheet of skin, but if you just kind of put it on a metal frame, it's going to die because in order to keep skin and any other human cell alive, you need a whole system that's going to pump blood and nutrients into it and keep the cells regenerating. Like, building them once, that's one thing. And if you're then grafting it onto an existing human body, it's going to become a part of this existing system. But creating that system from scratch is actually fairly complicated. And when you start to think about the level of complexity that we see on Westworld, where it's not just, again, skin on a metal frame, but, you know, skin with a whole system of blood so that these robots can bleed, so that they, again, can get injured in a convincingly human fashion and bruise and get black eyes. And then they're able to eat and they're able to do all of these things. Presumably, they still have similar lubrication systems to us. Like, their eyes are going to be lubricating the way human eyes are. I'm sure they have to produce some kind of saliva. And while it might be possible to do a kind of bio and technology hybrid to create that, probably what you're going to see, what it seems like in the show, is that really it's more they've just recreated a human body and then grafted it onto a metal frame, which is really, really challenging. And, you know, there's certain systems you can absolutely leave out, but it's like a tapestry. If you start pulling at the different threads, you might have unexpected fallout. And to get a whole integrated system that's working and convincingly looks like a biological life form requires a level of information and understanding of the human body that we don't have yet.
How about the artificial intelligence component? Are we anywhere close to seeing robots that can think for themselves, build upon that knowledge, and even develop unique personalities?
So again, as I said, I thought when I was going into this that that would be the part that we would be closest to. Because when you think about it, it seems like, oh, well, you know, I can talk to Siri and there's Alexa. And obviously, if we have all these robotic assistants, getting the technology or getting this technology that just living in a box, not in a human body, that seems relatively easy. But it's actually, that's actually like a common fallacy that you see in AI. The researcher I spoke with, Kate Compton, told me about AI summers and AI winters. And we're currently, according to her, in about the fourth AI summer. In an AI summer, everything seems really, really promising. There's all this investment capital going into AI. Everyone's really excited. They're convinced we're about to overcome all these challenges. And then eventually they hit a roadblock and the funding dries up and you go into an AI winter. So this has happened multiple times. And one of the biggest stumbling blocks is what she referred to as a strong AI problem. And the way she explained that to me was that if I go to a grocery store and I see someone I know, that seems like a pretty simple interaction. Like, oh, I'm just going to say hi to them. And it seems like, on the surface, that's not hard. I just program a robot to say hi to someone in the grocery store. But when you start to think about it a little deeper, there's so many different layers. Am I angry at this person? Is this someone I know well? Is this someone I don't know that well? Is this someone I haven't seen in a few months? Is this someone I see every day? Is this someone who owes me a favor? There's so many different levels of social interaction. And integrating that complexity into an artificial intelligence is really, really challenging. There's all sorts of nuance. Maybe I see that person in the grocery store and I can tell from their face that they're having a bad day and they don't want to talk to me. Like, how do you program that kind of nuanced understanding of human interaction?
Lux Alpdrom is with us. She's a writer and a consultant, and she's also a sex educator who, inspired in part by Westworld, the HBO series, started looking into how far along we are into creating very human-like androids, which populate the series. Well, that, I guess, is why it's fiction. You know, there's no underlying system yet for creating and feeding skin. There's no ability to interpret or exhibit nuanced social cues. But how about that idea of the funding, the AI winter, that seeing robots like this, seeing even in fiction, inspires us and pushes us forward and maybe even pushes science and funding towards discovering and creating something like these robots?
So I think there's definitely a history of science fiction inspiring science fact. Like if you look at the technology that was in Star Trek, for instance, versus the technology that we have now, there's obviously some influence there. Like there's the communicators in the early Star Trek definitely were very similar to modern cell phones. Or there's just a lot of times where people see it and they want to make it real and they pursue it. We still don't have hoverboards that are really hoverboards, but you have people trying to get hoverboards. And I definitely think to some extent we will see a West potential for a Westworld effect, but maybe not in quite as direct a way as we've seen with other forms of technology. Because I think one thing that really needs to be considered when we talk about super realistic, super lifelike robots is, why do we want them? And I've had a lot of conversations about this over the years. There was a book a few years ago by Dr. David Levy called Love and Sex with Robots that was just really taking for granted this idea that in a few decades, we'll be having romantic relationships with robots. And I found that very strange, and I find a lot of this assumption that absolutely we're going to have really human-like robots as a guarantee very, very strange, because as we've noted, it takes a lot of money to fund the research on all of this stuff, and you kind of have to have a consumer demand for what's very likely going to be a very expensive product. And when you start to piece together like the path we would have to go down to achieve this end goal, to me it starts to seem not particularly feasible. Now that doesn't mean that we're not going to see some scientific advances that are inspired by Westworld that are really awesome and really important. I mean, one of the things that came up in my conversation with Amy Carl is that the technology that would be needed to create an organic exterior is also technology that could be applied to, say, regenerating a finger. If you lose part of a finger, maybe we could grow you a new one. Or if you have some other kind of injury, maybe we can help you heal faster. And I think research towards a Westworld type robot could certainly come in handy for those kinds of things. And I think those applications would be far more useful than just creating more human-like creatures when we already have a lot of humans.
So if it were possible and you had a whole lot of money, is Westworld a place that you would like to visit?
So I'm torn on that. I mean, there's part of me that is very, very curious about what it would be like. And part of the thesis of the show is that being in this world where there are no consequences to your actions teaches you who you really are. And there is a part of me that's like, ooh, would I go to this theme park and would I kill people and would I do terrible things because they're not really people? But there's also part of me that's not even interested in that exploration, and it's not necessarily convinced that the really grim view of humanity that Westworld posits is actually true. I mean, I think a lot of people are like, oh, well, people love violent video games and people love this and people love that. But I think we do have this barrier where if something is truly human-like, even if we know it's not human, we're probably not going to get that much joy out of causing it pain and causing it suffering. When you look at kind of the history of war, people have to really dehumanize and really detach from their enemies before they're actually able to just... There's a reason why we're switching to drone warfare, because it's much easier to get people to pull the trigger when they don't have to see the face or don't have to deal with their enemies' humanity. So this idea that we're going to make really, really lifelike robots and rich people are going to go kill them for their vacation, I think it's an interesting fantasy. It's an interesting topic to explore, but maybe I'm a little too optimistic about humanity to think that most of us actually would find that it's not what we want to do with our vacation time.
Lux Alptrom, writer and sex educator, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
You'll find a link to read her article for Motherboard, How Long Before We Can Build Westworld Host Robots for Real. The link is at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Imagine a hammer that looks like a hammer, works like a hammer, but weighs a lot less than a hammer. Or a battery that can change voltage depending on which power tool you're using. Or an air purifier that doesn't just collect airborne particles, but destroys them. Those are just a few of the top 10 household innovations of 2016, according to Popular Science. They've gathered the year's best of what's new for the 29th year running, and we're getting the details on some of the must-have gadgets straight from the source. Kevin Gray is articles editor for Popular Science and joining us with a little more about what's new in home innovation for 2016. And Kevin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So out of all these new gadgets and inventions released each year, of course, you do have categories, you know, green, auto, engineering, software. How do you narrow it down to just 100?
It's very difficult. We start at least 6-7 months in advance of this issue, and we probably consider 10,000 items, if not more. And we have several researchers who look into these different fields. We break it down by category, as you just noted: home, gadgets, electronics, health. Our whole staff gets together, and we go over each and every entry, and we vet them, and we say, does this belong on our list? Is it a leap forward in the technology? Is it groundbreaking? Is it revolutionary? Or is it just an iteration on something that we have already seen before? And if it's just an iteration or a minor tweak, we push it aside and we just look for the best, most revolutionary entries we can find.
So let's just hit on the Popular Science's number one home innovation of the year. A hammer, you know, not something you think would be redesigned. What is it about this one that makes it?
No, it does seem like the mousetrap, right?
Right.
I mean, it does what you want it to do.
Looks like a hammer?
It looks exactly like a hammer, and you couldn't tell that it's not, except for the fact that it has, the shaft of it is made out of aircraft-grade aluminum. So it's very strong and very light, but the head of it is also filled with steel shot, and what that does is when you hit the hammer, it dampens the vibration from the blow. That allows for like maximum force in every hit. The problem that solves is that carpenters or anybody doing a project around the house on the weekend who's doing a lot of banging nails, it's exhausting. It's not only tiring, but the vibration can actually hurt you after a while. It can, you know, fracture a tiny bone in your hand or just, you know, just fatigue the heck out of you. So this hammer does away with that.
And since we're focusing on home innovation, some of them, you know, products that are being developed, already made, often brand names. Number three, the Bosch Reax, the safest table saw. What makes it safe and how does it change the game?
You're right. There are a lot of brand names and we try to find a lot of things that are on Kickstarter or that are just starting out. But a lot of these folks have some pretty, you know, smart R&D departments working on these problems. So that's why you'll see a number of these things. The Bosch saw is pretty remarkable because you cannot cut your finger off with it. And that is a problem for the DIYer and the weekend woodworker. You turn your focus for a moment and you can lose a digit, if not worse. This saw has a sensor that is able to detect the slightest intrusion of human flesh. So it knows the difference between wood and your thumb, and it will stop in a millisecond if it detects that.
Number five is a Nelson solar activated facade, which sounds fantastic and futuristic, but what does it mean?
What it does is it's a solar facade, so it's made of wood and glass, and so it both heats the home, or warms it rather, and cools it. So in winter, it lets the sun's rays pass through a glass facade and warm an internal layer of louvered wood. And that wood then traps the heat to create like a thermal buffer, you know, against the cold at night. But then in the summer, when the sun is higher in the sky, the rays strike these angled wooden slats, and that creates a shading effect for the home, keeping it cool.
Amazing idea. So, but does Popular Science test these kind of things independently?
You know what? That's a great question. We try to get every single product in our office to test it. We can't get a house in our office, and we couldn't even get the louvered facades. In those cases, when something's just too big and it needs to be field tested, either we go out in the field and test it, or we have experts who do it. We'll hire somebody in that part of the world or that part of the country to go do it, or we'll have to rely on outside engineers to vet the thing for us. We don't just take a company's word on something. We don't just accept their claims. I should raise one point. There are a lot of claims that just don't, that have no merit, and we end up finding those pretty quick.
We're talking about some of the newest, snazziest, most interesting and innovative items for your home, according to Popular Science. They've been gathering the best of what's new for 29 years, and we're going through this year's home innovations list. Well, many of the innovations, they do sound interesting, but maybe a lot more expensive because they are new, freshly minted from R&D departments. And there's a paint, Sherwin-Williams Paint Shield. $85 a gallon for paint, helps kill bacteria in your home. Samsung's Hub refrigerator, $6,000 for a fridge with cameras in it. So are these more of an indicator of what is going to become more common in the future rather than, you know, something that you might run out and buy right now?
You know, $85 a gallon is a lot for paint. Anybody who's ever painted their house knows that. You can get a much better deal with some in-store brand at Home Depot or Lowe's or something like that. But a lot of people are worried about bacteria in their homes. And I have a 2.5-year-old and my wife has another baby on the way. This is important to me. You know, I would like to eliminate that extra layer of concern that I have about my child's health. So I'll go out and I'll buy this to make sure that the house is as clean as possible. I will not go out and buy a $6,000 refrigerator because I'm not in that income bracket, but a lot of people are, and it's super convenient. This refrigerator has internal cameras, and if you're at the supermarket, even if you've written up a list, you wonder, oh, did I forget something? Do I have something at home? Do I already have this tahini sauce sitting in the door of the refrigerator? You click on an app, boom, you got an inside picture of your refrigerator, and it tells you whether you have that or not. Is that for everybody? No, but it is pretty convenient. And I'm sure, as with most technological entries to market, the price will eventually come down.
Right. Any of these innovative gadgets from past years of Popular Science, you know, you thought this is really going to change the game. It's going to be groundbreaking, that did not take off?
Well, it's funny you should say that. every once in a while, we have a miss, we have a fail. I was looking through some back issues, as we always do when we put this together. We need to know what we've covered before. But we wrote about a little item called the Apple Newton. I don't know if anybody remembers that from 1993, but it was Steve Jobs' entry into the handheld palm computer market. And it was a bomb. It did disastrously. And mostly because it had a stylus. And Jobs has famously said, no more styluses after this Newton. So that was something we thought was going to be a hit, and it wasn't. We also thought mini discs, mini CDs would be a hit. that didn't take off.
Yeah, anyone with a garage box full of those knows.
Let's hope not.
Well, and finally, okay, so number 10. This is the $150 travel mug that gets the temperature of your beverage right every single time.
Virginia, totally worth it.
Really?
Put it on your Christmas list.
Seriously?
I'm going to tell you why. I get up every morning at 6 a.m. with my son. I hang out for about 2 hours. Because I'm busy, my coffee is sitting there, and I'm constantly putting it in the microwave, reheating it.
Yeah.
So that's something I think, that's expensive for a coffee mug, but it does what you want it to do.
Yeah, spread it out over a lot of days. Makes sense.
Ask for it for, you know, a special occasion. Maybe somebody will gift it to you.
Well, Kevin, I guess the Christmas shopping season is going to start soon enough, so thank you.
Thanks, Virginia.
Kevin Gray, articles editor for Popular Science. You'll find a link to see the entire list of 2016's top household innovations, as well as the top 10 innovations in several other categories. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. What happens when you hear someone say like 4 times per sentence? Or how about, I literally just said that? Give you a little shiver of judginess. My guest John McWhorter writes that language is ever in flux. If English did not change, you'd be hearing this.
And specially from every Shire's ender of Engeland to Canterbury thy wender.
John McWhorter teaches linguistics at Columbia University and has written several books on language. His newest is called Words on the Move, Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still. And John McWhorter, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So if I were to sum it up, you say embrace, don't condemn changes in English.
Yeah, I do. And I think it needs to be understood that I don't mean that as some sort of socio-political attitude. I don't mean that one is best off letting it all hang out in some sort of libertarian way. This isn't a matter of spirit or mood or personality type. What I mean is that language has always changed, and I think we understand that when it comes to our not speaking Middle English and, frankly, not minding. But we have a sense that even if it changed in the past, that there's something about the present that means that it's supposed to stop changing. And so I think we all understand that there are going to be new words for new things, and that sometimes those are going to come from other languages. I think we all understand that slang changes. I'm not sure if we know why, but we know that we use different slang than, say, flappers did in the 20s. But beyond that, we hear a new way people are putting things, and we think, well, that's not the way it used to be, and it's wrong. I wish I weren't hearing that. And in Words on the Move, I try to get across that what we're hearing that's new is how language has always changed because it couldn't not change. And that these are the exact kind of changes that turned Latin into French, which most people don't seem to mind.
Well, you say it's a parade, just keeps on going. But still a lot of people bristle or conversely send complaints to their public radio stations when they hear somebody say like a few times. So if you're saying embrace it, how do you embrace that change? How do you unlearn the way you think of something and how it's heard?
Well, you know, you can't unlearn it completely. I mean, we live in a society where there's considered to be a formal way of speaking, but then there's also an informal way of speaking. And I heartily espouse that people be taught that in order to be taken seriously in certain contexts, there are certain habits you need to develop or undevelop. You can't pretend that that isn't true. Even if you're a linguist who knows that language is always changing, even if you're a linguist who knows that a lot of the informal things that people say have the same complex structure as the formal things. They're just what you do informally, like genes. And so, for example, with like the way the teenage girl that I think we spontaneously imagine uses it, is actually as complex as the workings of electricity or an erector set. It's really a beautiful thing, the subtleties that people encode with that like. It's not just spraying the word all over your sentence in an unsystematic way. Nevertheless, because like sounds like it's a hesitation because of what the original meaning of like was, I tell people, if you are giving a presentation, if you're giving a conference talk, if you're appearing in the media, if you want to not sound jejune, you need to pull back on the likes, whether it's fair or not. Now, as a linguist, I think, no, it's not fair. However, life isn't. And so, yeah, there's certain ways you need to speak. But I think, given that informal language is most of what language is, and it's most of what we hear, I think we can develop a new way of hearing it, because to hear all of the new things as mistakes, not only is it depressing, but it actually doesn't correspond to the science of what language is any more than you would look at a pigeon and say that that's wrong because that's not the way birds looked in the Cretaceous period. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, there are other words that we no longer question, like the word silly, for example, one that you point out, which used to mean something entirely different, or apple, which used to refer to all fruit, or meat was always called flesh. Tell us, for example, about silly.
Oh, silly is very interesting. We use silly. We know what it means. But if we were using it 1,000 years ago, it would have meant blessed. That's what the word meant. If any of you know German, selig, it's the same root, meant blessed. But words' meanings are always inching along into something else because there are always these resonances that surround the word, things that we feel like it kind of means, which, as time goes by, often come to be what the word actually means. If you're blessed, presumably, you're innocent. After a while, the word meant innocent. If you're innocent, you could be thought to possibly be not strong but weak. Again, not fair, but unfortunately that is a resonance of the word innocent. To be innocent is to lack power. So after a while, silly meant weak. Now, if you're weak, then you might be not only weak of strength, but it might be weak of mind. So now this word that originally meant blessed meant, frankly, dummy. Then, if you're weak of mind, well, you might be kind of a goofy sort of person, bouncing off the walls and not really knowing how to rub a noun and a verb together, you might be a silly billy. And so that's where the word happens to be now. And it used to be blessed. The change wasn't anything that anybody ever detected. But this is what's important. It's not that silly is somehow some special who-to-thunk-it case, like some unusual you know, fish that walks on land or something like that. All words are always changing in that kind of way. So when we hear people using words with a new meaning, to think, well, that's wrong because the dictionary says this, actually doesn't make any more sense than looking at a Polaroid of somebody in 1978 and then them walking in the room and you looking at them and thinking, well, that's wrong because they look like this in the picture. Of course, they're going to look different. And not just older. I mean, it would be wrong to look at a Polaroid taken in 1978 and see somebody walk in 1988. They don't look that different. Their hair isn't gray yet. But it's just that they've changed from age 19 to 29.
Well, there are other words that also, they have two opposite meanings. You know, silly and blessed feel like they're in different places, but quite literally, I'm going to say, have two opposite meanings. That word literally, you spend a lot of time on that.
Yeah, people seem to think that literally is a problem because nowadays you can use it to mean figuratively, which seems to be the opposite of literally. So if somebody says, I was literally dying of thirst, if they tell you that, presumably they did not die. They don't mean that they were in danger of death. They were just heightening their figurative description of how thirsty they were. So people think that something has gone wrong. That is completely understandable. But really, there are a lot of words that mean both one thing and their opposite. A language often has whole collections of words like that. And in English, depending on how you count it, there's several dozen. And literally has just joined the pack. And more to the point, many, many centuries ago, many people seem to think that literally went off the rails 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. But there are examples of that way back. I think the earliest that I know of is in the 18th century, and that probably was not even when it started. But think about fast. You run fast, but then you're stuck fast or you're fast asleep. So fast either means rapid or it means sitting stock still. Nobody cares. Think about the word seed. If you seed a watermelon, you're not putting the seeds back in, you're taking them out. But then if you seed the ground, you're not taking the seeds out of the ground, you're probably going to be putting them in. And we don't worry about this because context always takes care of it. And the truth is, with literally, how many times have we ever actually supposed that somebody was talking about their death or anything that they were heightening figuratively? We know what they mean. And as long as there's the clarity, then there's a real question as to whether there's anything wrong with it. And to tell you the truth, I'm even being polite in saying there's a question. If clarity isn't interfered with, it's fine.
So you're talking about language in evolution, but dictionaries, they try and they fail to cement language in a specific time and place and have ever since Samuel Johnson was first writing his in the 18th century in English. So what do you think of some of the more fluid, these online dictionaries, Wikipedia or Urban Dictionary? Is that a better model?
Yeah, I think that for dictionaries responsibly edited to be online and constantly responsive to the changes in the language year by year, even month by month, is really the way it should be. That was impossible until very recently. But dictionaries are great. Needless to say, I certainly have more of them than the average person. But what they are is Polaroid snapshots. What worries me is when you're at some sort of symposium or the like and somebody says, here is the definition of X, and they have something taken from Webster's dictionary with the implication that that definition is somehow equivalent to one of Plato's forms. It's way up on high and it's sacrosanct, when really that definition is just what that word meant when they compiled the dictionary. So you can look at a dictionary from 1966, and I have for this particular thing, and you're thinking about French fries. How do you pronounce French fry? Well, in 1966, what they had was French fry. The original pronunciation was, well, let's have some French fries, some fries that are French. Then it became French fry. So you look at the Random House Dictionary of 1966. Well, looking at that, if the dictionary is so sacred, then why aren't we talking about McDonald's taking the beef tallow out of their French fries? So, yeah, this is one area, and during this election, it's nice to find one, where the internet is a good thing.
I'm speaking with John McWhorter. He's an author of many books on language. His latest book is called Words on the Move, Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still. Well, I don't think many people are going to say, I think language should never change. I mean, it's got to stay the same. It can't age. But how about when we hear pronunciations shift, like nuclear? You know, there is, as you were saying, you know, people are going to judge that on some level, aren't they? Or is that just how people are going to say this in 10 years because it's become popularized?
Well, it's hard not to judge it because language doesn't just sit. hanging. Language has social evaluations. And so nuclear is the way it's spelled. Nuclear is the way it was originally pronounced. And now nuclear is one, new, and two, it has for many of us a certain Southern association. And for better or for worse, Southern English is often associated with lack of intelligence. That's not fair, but it's true. And three, George W. Bush, who was extremely unpopular in many quarters, seems to have taken on a certain symbolic status as the bearer of nuclear, and so that makes it even worse. But the truth is that as words go through time, it's inevitable that people are going to start pronouncing them based on ways that you hear them that compare to other words. You're going to make little what begin as mistakes, but they're mistakes that are so tempting that after a while, such a large number of people are making the quote-unquote mistake that you can't help but think of it as just the way the language is changing, for the simple reason that the way any language changes into another one is through a gradual series of what we would call mistakes. There's no other way to get from, say, modern English to old English. A person who spoke old English would listen to modern English and think of it as the most barbaric, sloppy, mistaken English they had ever heard. And we think, well, no, it changed. And it's the same thing with nuclear. So nuclear, there you go. And it's a scientific sounding word. Then people think of words like, say, tubular, that really do end in ular. You have a word like spectacular, which feels kind of good to say, sticks in the mind, and it has ular. And so you think to yourself, okay, nuclear, or is it a word where we're talking about something which is nuclear, especially because there's a slang verb, nuke, and so you're thinking that nuclear is something having to do with nuking? All of that goes on in any ordinary mind subconsciously, because all of these things do seem rather like one another. Next thing you know, instead of saying nuclear, you're saying nuclear, just as somebody might say library instead of library, because berry comes so much more easily to mind than brary. Now, if it's just one person, that's just a strange thing that they say. But nuclear is so tempting that it isn't just George Bush. For the record, it isn't just people who are uneducated or inarticulate. It's quite common among many thoroughly sober, educated people, to the point that we have to accept that that word is changing itself. Now, do I say nuclear? I don't happen to, and I don't think I ever will. If my little daughter said nuclear, would I tell her, actually, the proper word is nuclear, you have to watch out for nuclear? I would tell her that, because there are social impressions. But if, especially as the decades went by, nuclear got to the point that as many people were saying nuclear as nuclear, if we haven't actually hit that point already, I would let my Dahlia say nuclear, because language changes. It couldn't be otherwise, any more than the clouds would stay in the same pattern from one day to another.
Okay, so if words drift, there are no mistakes, or mistakes are the origins of change, what does bother you? What do you make sure you would correct your little daughter on?
You know, there are things, and I feel so guilty when I do it. And so, for example, my daughter, like a great many little kids, often says axe instead of ask. Mm-hmm. It's very tempting. And I thought about it. The first few times I heard her say, she's four. First few times I heard her say axe, I thought, just let her, because she's going to be saying ask at the proper age. And so we need not worry. But why did I think worry? Because axe has a particular status. Once again, not fair, but life isn't fair. Particular status as sounding uneducated. That is especially the case with black people. I'm black. My daughter is half black, whatever that means in 2016. So if she says axe, it has a particular meaning that it might not if she were blonde with blue eyes. So actually, a few weeks ago, I said, you know, actually, Dolly, technically, the way to say that word where you're kind of better off in general is ask. And of course, she said, I know, and she still says axe. But I must admit, when I hear the axe, I think, I must admit that even descriptivist, let it all hang out linguist me worries that she needs to buck up with that one when you're trying to be taken seriously.
Well, and so, bring up, you know, that if she did have blonde hair and blue eyes and was saying axe, there would be a sense of language appropriation in that case. There's so much more here. You know, there are levels of region and education and class. And now that so many people are coming to America, trying to learn English, all kinds of ways that the language will change and all kinds of different baggage that comes with that.
Oh, yeah. All of those things are extremely real. Like, for example, with the appropriation, what I actually think about with my daughter, she's not going to sound black on the phone. I was told my whole life that I don't either until I wrote an article where I said that it can be hard being a black person who doesn't sound black, upon which I heard from a bunch of people that I do. Well, if I do, great. But my daughter definitely will not. And, you know, that can be a bit of a handicap when you're black or brown. And so sometimes I think to myself, it's interesting that just the shape of her vowels is probably going to get her in a little trouble with some people who think that she is somehow disidentifying from something by not having a certain sound that most people of color, most black people, subconsciously do. So yeah, language is extremely complicated. And it's in thinking about things like that, actually, which are messy and sensitive and often painful, that makes me think of writing a book like Words on the Move, where I think, now, in the meantime, there are people who don't like the way literally is being used, or who think that nuclear is a bad thing to say because George W. Bush said it. All that's easier. Now, once we get into issues of cultural appropriation, language and class, language and race, language and economics, that stuff isn't as easy. So Words on the Move is a pretty sunny book, and I'm putting forth something where I feel like, here are simple truths that almost anybody could accept if we just pull the camera back. The rest of it will be subject to endless controversy. So I just hope we can get the easy stuff out of the way. So then we can figure out some of these richer issues.
John McWhorter, a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
John McWhorter of Columbia University. His latest book is called Words on the Move, Why English Won't and Can't Sit Still. There's much more in the book at wordofmouthradio.org. And we are, like, literally so glad that you caught up with us today. Music in this episode came to us from Poddington Bear and Delay. There's a lot more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And you can listen to the show on your own time with the Word of Mouth podcast. You find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or in Google Play. We're on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.